It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a UW System student survey on free speech was supposed to go out yesterday, but was postponed at the last minute. We'll learn more about the survey and why it's been delayed. Now, whether we're making breakfast, dinner, or dessert, there's probably a good chance to use eggs. They're one of the most versatile ingredients out there, and we're talking about them this week on Food Friday. Our guest is here to share some creative ways to use eggs, especially fresh eggs that we get at the farmer's market or maybe our own backyard. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite way to make and or eat an egg? Fried, scrambled, poached, baked, something else? What tips have you learned over the years for getting eggs just right? Do you have questions about how to make eggs in the best way? And do you raise your own chickens? What's that been like for you? Do you notice a difference between fresh eggs and less fresh eggs? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lisa Steele is a fifth-generation chicken keeper, a master gardener, and creator of the blog Fresh Eggs Daily. She's the author of several books. Her latest is the Fresh Eggs Daily Cookbook, over 100 fabulous recipes to use eggs in unexpected ways. Lisa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, raising chickens has been part of your life since you were a kid and something you came back to as an adult. What led you to devote yourself to sharing knowledge about raising chickens and what to do with the eggs?
You know, it turns out that there are a lot of people interested in it. I started as an adult back in 2009. It was the recession. A lot of people were looking at where their food was coming from or worried about it and out of work. And backyard chickens started to really grow in popularity. And we're kind of seeing that again over the last 2 years. There's been a huge interest in raising backyard chickens. And I thought it was time to write a cookbook to help people know what to do with all those eggs.
You say right away in the book, fresh eggs are going to be better to cook with. They're going to taste better. They're going to cook better. Why is that? Why is there such a difference?
There really is a big difference. And it's because as an egg ages, it loses a lot of moisture through the pores in the eggshell. So as the egg gets older, it's not going to taste good. It's going to be drier, not as full of water. And also the white thins out and the membrane around the yolk thins out. So for example, when you're frying an egg, when you drop that egg into the pan, if it's super fresh, it's just going to stay there. If it's an older egg, it's going to spread out all over your pan, which of course you don't want.
Not all of us are going to have chickens in the backyard. For people who don't, what is your best advice on finding the freshest possible eggs?
Absolutely. Your own chickens are the best. I definitely have to say that. But drive around your neighborhood. I would venture a guess that there are some of your neighbors who are raising chickens and might have a fresh egg sign outside. Go to a farmer's market or to a small specialty. Some of the more upscale grocery stores will stock local eggs. Or if you do go to a regular supermarket, you can look at the end of the egg carton for the secret code that tells you how old the eggs actually are. And once you know how to read that code, you can easily pick out the freshest off the supermarket shelf.
How do we read that code?
So it's a 3-digit code on one end of the egg carton from 001, which corresponds to January 1st, all the way to 365, which is December 31st. And that's the day of the year that those eggs were put in that carton. So you want to look for the highest number, which is going to be the day closest to the current day.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Lisa Steele, creator of the blog Fresh Eggs Daily. She has chickens. She therefore has eggs. She has a new book out called The Fresh Eggs Daily Cookbook, over 100 fabulous recipes to use eggs in unexpected ways. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your egg cooking questions. There are a lot of things that a lot of us do wrong, it turns out, including me. 800-642-1234. Or if you raise chickens yourself, love to hear from you, your story, how you got into it, what you do with all the eggs. 800-642-1234 is the number, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's talk about some of those things that some of us do wrong, Lisa. Now, this one I've done. I crack the egg on the side of the bowl, of course, and then drop it right into my batter or whatever. Two mistakes right there. Clear me up, please.
Yes, two mistakes. Yes, so you should always crack an egg on a flat surface. When you use the corner of a counter or the corner of your bowl, you risk pushing little pieces of the eggshell or whatever bacteria is on that shell into the egg, and nobody wants that. So that's your first mistake. So always on a flat surface. And then the second mistake is cracking right into your batter or whatever you're making, because if that egg is bad for some reason, or if you do have pieces of eggshell, they're going to be really hard to get out of the batter. So you always want to crack an egg into a small bowl separately. The mistake you didn't make, though, that I have made, is cracking an egg and then right over the stand mixer as the mixer is going. Because if that mixer catches the eggshell, you will never get it all out of your batter.
Wow. Yeah, no, that one I have not done. You also talk about, and I didn't know this, it sounds like especially for baking, but for some purposes, it matters what temperature your egg is when you start. Like if you're just pulling it out of the fridge, what's the rule for that?
It really does. You know, as much as ingredients matter, the temperature of ingredients matters. So if it calls for cold butter, you want your butter to be cold. If it calls for room temperature eggs, you want them to be room temperature. If you're adding cold eggs to a batter or a mix, it's going to cause the fats in that to seize up. So it's not going to mix up as well, and things aren't going to incorporate the way that they should. So if it does say room temperature milk or eggs or whatever it is, they should be at room temperature. And I mean, it's not a lot, although I always forget myself, but 30 minutes out on the counter should bring that egg up to room temperature.
Brianna caller now at 800-642-1234. David starts us off in Iron River. David, hi.
Hello. Yeah, I'm calling. As I told your screener there, kind lady, I might add, I've been raising chickens really since Shep was a puppy. You know, that's a long time, about 60 years. I found, back in my old pulp peeling days, I was peeling pulp. I would make egg sandwiches. I'd cook up 4 eggs the night before. I found the best way to cook egg sandwiches, and there's nothing better than a good egg sandwich, in my opinion, is you cook them on medium heat. And the fresh eggs, I listened to your lady talking there about how when a good egg gets in the pan, it doesn't run all over the world. It kind of stays with you. The yolk sits up nice. If you've ever had your own eggs and your own chickens, I certainly know what she was talking about. And the yolk is brighter, it's oranger. And I just wanted to say that, none of our old girls ever die. Except natural deaths at our place. We keep them, and we get about 5 or 6 eggs. We don't have a big flock, but they are just outstanding. I'd like to read the literature your host has put out there, your host lady.
David,
I think that.
Thanks a lot for sharing that story. David really is into those eggs. He pre-makes an egg sandwich, or used to when he worked, pre-made an egg sandwich to bring into work with him. Lisa, do you have thoughts on the best way to, because you're not going to fry up the eggs at work, at most workplaces,
Right.
unless you work at a restaurant, I guess. Do you have thoughts on, pre-preparing something like that?
I mean, I think that's a great idea. I don't think there's anything wrong with making an egg sandwich at home in the morning and, putting the cheese on and everything, and then maybe heating it up when you get to work. I mean, I never really thought about that. I kind of think of as hard-boiled eggs as what you would maybe travel with, but I think making an egg sandwich is great.
David, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Marcus joins us now in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. I've had this debate going on with a couple of people and never really quite come to a good answer. So I was hoping maybe your guest could help us out, Rob. The question is should an egg be, like kind of pre-rinsed or pre-washed before being cracked, just in case, like you said before, like you have a piece of shell fall in there? I mean, I always figured that if you cooked it hot enough, it would kill the bacteria, hopefully, but I've heard both ways, and I guess I was just wondering for some input.
Marcus, thanks for the call. I gotta say, Lisa, I don't think I've ever pre-washed an egg. Should I be?
Well, commercially, store-bought eggs have been washed before they're put in the carton, which is why they have to be refrigerated. So if you're buying commercial eggs, no, you don't really need to wash them. But if you are raising your own chickens or buying from a neighbor or a farmer's market, yes, it's a good idea to rinse the eggs in warm water just before you use them. That kind of rinses off any bacteria that might be on the shell, and that that's it's just good practice. There's nothing wrong with washing commercial eggs also, but it is important if you do have fresh eggs that you rinse them off just before you use them.
Excellent. Marcus, hope that resolves the debate for you. It's Food Friday. We're talking to Lisa Steele right now about her book, The Fresh Eggs Daily Cookbook. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your favorite way to eat eggs? Do you have a cooking problem you need solved when it comes to your favorite eggy recipes? Do you have access to farm fresh eggs, whether that's your own farm, your own backyard, or maybe your neighbors or that farmer's market? Do you notice the difference in how they cook, bake, and taste? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll have a recipe or two coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our Food Friday talk with Lisa Steele, author of the book The Fresh Eggs Cookbook, over 100 fabulous recipes to use eggs in unexpected ways. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your favorite egg-related recipes, your egg questions, and let us know if you have a backyard chicken operation going on. 800-642-1234. You can find some recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. And Lisa, before we go back to our callers, let's check out a recipe now. Now, I love squash and I like eggs. You've got baked eggs in butternut squash rings. These look pretty cool. How does this come together?
Really beautiful, but if you do love squash, it's a different way to make it. You basically slice your squash up, cut out the seeds and all the guts inside, and then little olive oil, salt, and pepper, bake them till they get a little bit soft, you know, not completely cooked, but then you want to take them out of the oven, add an egg, add a little Parmesan cheese, a little more olive oil, salt, and pepper, then back in the oven until the egg is cooked to your liking. You can do jammy, runny, you know, hard cooked, whatever way you like your yolk. And then I like to have a little bit of fresh sage with them. I think sage and eggs go really well. But it's just a really pretty, nice dinner, especially if you're trying to not eat quite as much red meat, or if you have people coming over for dinner who might be vegetarian, because it's pretty hearty. You know, squash are, they're stick to your ribs.
And it sounds really easy, too.
Yes, super easy.
Awesome. You can join in at 800-642-1234 as we cook with eggs. Irene is with us now in Phillips. Irene, hi.
Can you hear me?
Yep. You're loud and clear, Irene. Go ahead.
Good. In my hands right now, I have a picture of a little boy with a chick on his shoulder. My cousin Lori's husband came home one day in Chicago and said, I bought a dozen eggs from a farmer, fresh eggs. Here they are. And she heard noises in her refrigerator, put one on the windowsill to bake in the sun, and a little chick popped out.
Wow.
And I think you have to be concerned about that once in a while. And I've never bought any since then, and my cousin Lori never did either. So thank you for listening.
Irene, thanks for the call. I guess that's something people want to avoid, Lisa, hatching the eggs they're planning to eat.
Yeah, well, yes, definitely. You know, we have a rooster. We collect eggs every day. They go right in the fridge. It takes 3 weeks at pretty elevated temperatures near 100 degrees for a chick to develop and then ultimately hatch. So definitely something was going on wrong there in the whole process from the coop to the carton, let's say.
Irene, thanks for sharing that with us. Aaron joins us now in Kenosha. Aaron, hello.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Aaron?
Well, I could talk about eggs all day. I've got my own flocks of ducks and chickens both, and I've got a million uses for them. But, in fact, I'm having omelets tonight on Meatless Friday. But so my question is, and I've researched this but never gotten a clear answer, after peeling 3 dozen duck eggs this morning, what's the best way to peel those doggone things after you hard cook them?
Man, oh, man, Aaron, I'm right there with you. I have difficulties peeling them well, and I do like hard-boiled eggs. Lisa, what's the secret?
Yes, I love this question because I get it a lot. Fresh eggs are hard to peel because air has not had time to get into the egg to push that membrane away from the shell. So the common advice is to just let the eggs get old, but who wants to eat old eggs? So you want to eat your eggs fresh. The trick is to steam them over simmering water. So in a double boiler, a colander, something like that, steam the eggs for 12 minutes, duck eggs would be 20 minutes. And then you want to put them right into ice water until they're cold enough to handle, and even eggs laid that morning will just peel like a charm. It works for either chicken or duck eggs, either 12 minutes or 20 minutes.
And you mentioned steaming instead of boiling the eggs.
Yes. And another benefit is sometimes when you're boiling eggs, they bounce around a little and they crack open, you know, while they're cooking. So when they're steaming, they're just sitting quietly in the steamer basket. So you don't get the cracked eggs. You don't get the broken eggs, which is also nice.
Thanks again for calling in and sharing that, Erin. Oh, one corollary here, Lisa. If I do have some eggs and I look at the code and they're kind of older, is boiling them probably one of the better uses for them?
At that point, yes. You know, they're going to peel well if they're older. You could hard boil them. You can use them as egg wash or something like that. You know, I wouldn't necessarily try to make a souffle or something where the egg really is the star of that dish, but to bread some eggplant cutlets or chicken cutlets or something like that, they're going to work just fine.
We are talking about eggs on this edition of Food Friday. Lisa Steele is with us. Her new book is The Fresh Eggs Daily Cookbook, over 100 fabulous recipes to use eggs in unexpected ways. Still time for your call with your favorite egg recipes, your egg stories, your experiences, your egg experiences, raising chickens in your own backyard, 800-642-1234. I'll show myself out. Kim is with us now in Iowa. Kim, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about, Kim?
Well, I'm calling in reference to how to take your eggs to work. I'm older, and when I was young, we would go to mass before school, and we were not allowed to eat until after communion. So in the morning, we would take an egg, we'd whip it up. We called them pancake eggs, but really they're omelets, one egg omelet, and you put it on bread and good butter, wrap it in wax paper, and then it's ready to go. It's delicious.
Excellent, Kim.
And
thanks.
I still make those.
You do. Kim, thanks for sharing that with us. Lisa, she mentioned these are effectively omelets. Do you have a favorite omelet secret to share with us?
Oh, I love making omelets. I think the secret is to use enough butter and to keep the temperature low, because you really don't want to brown the egg. You just want to cook it, not use too many eggs. Like she mentioned, just one egg, swirl it around in the pan. And I just like to do a trifold, you know, so you flip over both sides, even with no filling inside. If you have a nice, delicious, fresh egg, it's going to taste wonderful.
Thanks a lot for sharing that egg memory. David joins us now in Port Edwards. David, hi.
Hi. I'm just calling in regards to people in peeling a hard-boiled egg. My experience is to have cold water, take as many eggs that you're going to boil, like say six, and boil it, bring it to a boil, turn off the heat, cover it, 2 minutes per egg, and then over 12 minutes, it'll harden up. And then after that, drain the water, put cold water in it, let it sit until you get it handy, and then you can peel it right away with cold water.
David, thanks a lot for that call. And I got to say, Lisa, when I've researched online to find the secret to boiling eggs and peeling them, I found like 50 different answers. Your steaming one sounds pretty good, and I've never tried that, I got to say.
I think it's some kind of egg magic. But yes, I tried almost everything researching my book. And just because we do have so many eggs that I try to hard boil, and the steaming just works every time. I swear by it.
All right. Thanks a lot, David. We'll go to Bryce now in Wisconsin, I should say, not the state. Bryce, hi.
Hi there.
What'd you want to tell us about, Bryce?
Well, I wanted to mention that a number of years ago, there was a farm a few miles from me that I used to drive by periodically, and there was a sign in the yard there that was advertising their wares and services. The sign was hand-lettered sign. It said, "Fresh eggs will sharpen scissors."
So fresh eggs will sharpen scissors.
Yeah, and I just wanted to ask the guest if she's ever tried that, how it works to sharpen scissors with fresh eggs.
I'm gonna guess, Lisa, probably not.
I have not, but I love that sign, and that's why we all need to pay attention to our punctuation.
Bryce, thanks a lot for sharing that. Lisa, I got to say, one of my favorite ways to eat eggs is fried with some runny yolk, like on a sandwich, which you can't take it to work because it's way too messy. Do you have some advice for us on making the best fried eggs?
Yeah, I have to agree with you. I like, whether it's, you know, hard boiled or soft boiled, I like a jammy egg. I like it to be a little bit runny. I think if you fully cook it, you're kind of missing out, but it does kind of make a mess. But I mean, there's nothing better than making an egg sandwich with a runny yolk, some really great cheese, maybe some Wisconsin cheese.
Oh, yeah.
You know, nice toasted piece of rustic bread. You can even put some pesto on, you know, something like that. You really can't go wrong with an egg sandwich with a lot of cheese.
Butter or oil for frying that egg?
I'm going to say butter just because it adds so much flavor. But I do a combination sometimes, a little bit of oil with a little bit of butter.
And as we wrap up, just in our last minute or so, Lisa, what if you had to make a dinner, a fancy dinner right now, what would be your egg-led dinner?
Oh, you know, I would have to say Eggs Benedict, and I know that's not like a typical dinner, but
I'll
it's so elegant and fancy. I would eat it for dinner as well. Follow it up with some nice creme brulee. I just think that would be the perfect dinner.
Lisa, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for sharing this with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Lisa Steele is the creator of the blog Fresh Eggs Daily. She raises chickens. She joined us on this edition of Food Friday to talk about her newest book. It is called The Fresh Eggs Daily Cookbook, over 100 fabulous recipes to use eggs in unexpected ways. You don't have to be done with eggs just because we're done talking about them. You can find a couple recipes from Lisa. We've got the one we talked about, that baked eggs and butternut squash rings. That sounds really good. I'll try that in squash season this fall for sure. And we didn't get to this one, but it's online at WPR.org/Food Friday, a tomato caprese quiche. I like making a good quiche. I've got one in my freezer right now. Again, find both those recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. And there's still time for you to share your favorite egg dishes, your egg raising, your chicken raising experiences, and hey, maybe some pictures. You can do that on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Get a lively start to your weekdays on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Coming up Monday, from Russian threats to old-fashioned cybercrime and online scams, get the latest news from the world of cybersecurity, what it all means for you and your workplace. That's Monday morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. A survey for UW System students about issues of freedom of speech and expression has been postponed by the organizers. That survey also led in part to the resignation of UW-Whitewater's interim chancellor, we learned this week. WPR higher education reporter Rich Kramer has been following this story. Rich, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for being here. Or thanks for having me.
I'm glad to be here, too. That's okay. Who's behind this survey, Rich? Where is this thing coming from?
This is a partnership. It's coming from the Menard Center for, called the Menard Center for Institutional and Policy Research at UW-Stout in Menominee. And it's also in collaboration with an organization called WIPS, which is based in Wausau, the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service. Those are the two people behind it, organizations behind it. There's a advisory board that is overseeing, or was overseeing, the design of the survey, and but really still learning about who all is involved.
And what, give us a little bit of the backstory leading up to this week when this was postponed until next fall. Why has this survey kind of emerged as a story?
Well, because it was in the works and you know, a lot of people didn't know about it, the broader picture here is that individuals, in particular conservative individuals and lawmakers, have been critical of college campuses as kind of bastions of liberalism that stifle conservative speech and conservative speakers. So that's the backdrop. And then all of a sudden, there was this resignation that was sudden, and it was Jim Henderson, an interim chancellor at UW-Whitewater. He was pretty vague in his description, but I started hearing from people on campus and elsewhere that the resignation was about this survey. So then I got a hold of some lawmakers. I found out that an individual named Tim Scheel is at the Menard Center at Stout, and he was one of the he's the principal investigator in this, what he says is just a simple academic study. Mm-hmm. But the overall concern from some people was that politicians, Republican politicians, were getting involved in kind of pushing this to happen. But turns out that this is a survey that had been in the works since at least January, maybe earlier. Former interim UW system president Tommy Thompson was supportive of it. He even mentioned something about a survey of this type going to students before he left office January before he resigned. So that's kind of what we started piecing together on Tuesday, the day after Jim Henderson resigned, and still learning about it.
And now this was supposed to go out yesterday to students, and it did not. What happened?
Yeah, well, for lack of better terms, Tim Scheel felt that there was an avalanche of questions, he said, and there wasn't enough time to answer all of those questions. The goal had always been for the survey to go out April 7th, but because there were so many questions, Mr. Scheel decided to delay it. And the reason he wanted to get it done in the spring was because of a funding issue. The funding comes from the Menard Center, which is funded by the family of billionaire John Menard. And he said now that it's been delayed, he still thinks that the funding can come together. So that was part of it. But I also heard from State Representative Dave Murphy, a Republican from Greenville, also chair of the Colleges and Universities Committee in the Assembly, said that they too had reached out and they wanted to make sure that this happened in the spring. Initially, it sounded like there was discussion within UW system of whether they were going to participate or not. A couple weeks ago, I guess, interim president Michael Falbo, who is now UW system interim president, pulled the plug on it. But then Tim Scheel sent a letter saying, hey, we should do this. This is legitimate research. You know, there's a lot of misinformation, so we need to do this. We need to, with this data, we can kind of put these allegations of, conservatives being stifled on campuses to rest. So with that, interim president Falbo said, okay, we're back on. And then there was some disagreements, and that's what led to the resignation of Mr. Henderson from Whitewater.
We'll be talking to Tim Scheel on Central Time on Monday. So, Rich, for now, there's a holding pattern until the fall?
That's what it looks like. Yeah, there's not a specific date, but the fall semester, which will probably be here sooner than we would like, with regard to the winter weather. But but there's still a question. Like, there's no specific date. You know, funding could be an issue, supposedly. I'm not sure. And I've even heard from some, from a lawmaker saying, well, they say they're going to do it in the fall, but they're not so sure because there's been so much back and forth. It's really up in the air, but that's the plan, that it will go to all students at the 4-year universities.
Rich, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
That's Rich Kramer, higher education reporter at WPR. We talked to him today about a UW system survey for students about freedom of speech and expression. Delayed once again, scheduled to come out this week, now scheduled for next fall on Monday at 3:30 on Central Time. We'll talk to Tim Scheel from UW-Stout about the survey and what is going into it. Now, the National Highway Traffic and Safety Administration announced an increase in fuel economy standards in cars and other vehicles last week. Here's Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg last week referencing the corporate average fuel economy standards that followed the 1973 oil embargo.
Before those CAFE standards started in the 1970s, the average vehicle got about 13 miles per gallon. With the standards we're announcing today, by 2026, the average vehicle will get 49 miles per gallon.
We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What kind of fuel economy do you get with your vehicle or vehicles right now? Are you in the market for a new car? Are you looking at that gas mileage number? How big a deal is it for you? Do you want to see regulations move those numbers up, those fuel economy numbers up? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Steph Tai is a professor at UW-Madison's School of Law with a focus on environmental law, administrative law, and contracts. Steph, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me, Tim.
When you first heard about this new fuel economy standard, what is your first reaction to the numbers they're putting out and sort of the guidelines you're seeing?
Yeah, it seems like this has been in the making for a while. So when Biden issued his executive order regarding reconsideration of former rules, basically meaning the Trump administration rules, in incorporating science into their thing, into their discussions, this was in the works for a while because it sort of prompted the Department of Transportation to review whether or not the fuel economy standards were actually incorporating the state of the science in that. And that meant that the Trump administration's requirement of only a 1.5% annual increase in efficiency was, according to the Department of Transportation, not really in accordance with what would be acceptable according to the science of energy vehicle production, hybrid production, et cetera. And so they revisited that prior rule, and that's why they adopted this.
We just heard there, average of 49 miles per gallon. Average is a big word there, and the way the numbers are measured can be difficult to read. Is this statement, is this announcement as significant as it might sound at first glance?
It is, in the sense that it means that the automobile companies will have to incorporate a lot of like new technological developments in order to sort of reach that average kind of standard. So it does have some kind of effect, although it doesn't mean that every single instance of driving is going to reach that kind of standard.
Then there's the light truck question, which is, you know, a really popular kind of car. It covers a lot of things like pickups and SUVs and others. Where do those end up falling, those very widely used vehicles in our market?
Yeah, I think that's still going to be addressed in a future kind of rule. But one of the things that was done in a previous regulation was that the Biden administration restored California's ability to create even more stringent standards than the federal standards. And so, and this is part of this whole background of the Clean Air Act, where it really couldn't get passed without like California's assent. And what that meant was that California has always had the ability under the Clean Air Act to apply to the EPA and the Department of Transportation for an exception, right? An exception to it where they could create more stringent standards, mostly due to LA. And for that reason, they might still be able to address things. And the Biden administration seems willing to assent to California's ability to address things so that there are more stringent standards for light vehicles. Light trucks.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. George is with us in Ashland. George, hi.
Hi. Question. For my conventional pickup truck, fuel cost me about 30 cents a mile. And for my my EV, it cost me to operate about 5 cents per mile. So what I was wondering was whether the manufacturers under the new fuel standards get credit for their EV production.
George, thanks. Yeah, how do electric vehicles fit in, Steph?
Yeah, so they get credit in the sense that states have incentives now under this rule to create incentives for more production. And so it's up to the states in a way to create those incentives. There's also a lot of lobbying from various automobile manufacturers to create various incentives on the part of the federal government to help people meet the standard. And so we're going to see what happens in that mix. It's not entirely clear, but some of the stuff that might happen might be more sort of case by case or state by state kind of incentives.
George, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to UW-Madison Law Professor Steph Tighe, looking at new federal fuel economy and emissions standards. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of these new standards? Do they go far enough? Do you want to see more stringent regulations on fuel economy in vehicles sold in the U.S.? And do you want to see more incentives for things like those electric vehicles that our caller just brought up? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And as gas prices have gone up lately, does that have you thinking more about fuel economy? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with UW-Madison Law Professor Steph Tai, looking at new federal fuel economy standards as part of a larger Biden administration push to improve emissions and decrease the harmful effects of transportation on climate change. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions, your thoughts on vehicle mileage. Do you think it's more important to make our vehicles more fuel efficient because of concerns about global warming, about reliance on petroleum products from around the world? Call 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Drew is with us in Green Bay. Drew, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. I was just hoping to get your thoughts and some information on the state's additional taxes to electric vehicle owners. I think I understand that the purpose is that they're not paying fuel taxes at the pump. And I can take my answer off air.
Drew, thanks for that call. We get calls about this, I think, especially from EV owners. Steph, states, not just Wisconsin, charging additional fees because they're not collecting gas taxes from electric vehicles. Is that kind of at cross purposes with the efforts to encourage electric vehicles?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, Drew. And it really does point to the, I guess, mixed messages that states are sending, right? On one hand, sometimes they're trying to encourage fuel efficiency, but they're still adding in this stuff to increase basically state revenue. And so it is something where states are not actually always being on point about this. And I'm glad you point to this phenomenon. And I think, you know, it's unfortunate. And to the extent that you can participate as someone who cares about this issue, you can write to your sort of legislatures to talk about these kinds of different taxes. That said, one thing that states can do is they can also give rebates for purchases of electric vehicles. And some of the states that, even though they create additional fines for electric vehicles, can also create rebates for the purchases of them. And so there's all this sort of mixed messages that states send.
Drew, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Steph, part of the reason for these mileage changes, not the only reason, but part of it is climate change. How big a part of the picture is, you know, our transportation fleet, our cars and trucks in the United States when it comes to climate change related emissions?
So it varies from state to state. For some states, it's a really significant part of their climate change, carbon emissions. And for other states, it's not as much. And it really depends on sort of really how much vehicle driving there is within that state. So it varies a lot, but it's still a significant chunk in terms of different sectors if you average it around all states. So it's fairly significant, and it's something that it makes sense for the Biden administration to address. And it also makes sense to address things like supply chain kind of issues, right? Because we're seeing this right now with respect to sort of Russian sanctions. And so in terms of long-term supply chain planning, we only have so much in terms of strategic oil reserves. And so limiting our dependence on fossil fuels can help with future sort of energy needs.
Now, these kind of changes could have a slow result because they apply to new cars on the market.
Yes.
Most of the cars we're driving aren't brand new. So these things take a while to phase in. Can you talk about how that affects the impact of a change like this?
Yeah. So what it's seen as is it's like seen as a sort of technological ramping, right? The idea is that once a company is forced or pressured to put in place additional technologies, they're going to use them from now on, right? Because they've already adopted those technologies, they're engineered that technology. That's something that they continue to use. And so the idea is that even though it's a slow change in terms of creation of new cars, it's a faster change in terms of technology development.
We're talking to Steph Tai, law professor at UW-Madison, who specializes in environmental law, looking at this new fuel economy standard from the Biden administration, raising the average fuel economy in the American new car fleet. The goal, the average would be 49 miles per gallon. Still time for your call with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Big picture, Steph, you mentioned earlier, this is a reversal of a Trump administration standard, which itself was a reversal, I believe, an Obama administration standard. And so back, how much does that sort of ping pong back and forth affect the impact of changes like this?
So here's the thing about this is like administrations change, and I think manufacturers know that administrations change, so they plan for some degree of uncertainty. And so to the extent that they know that things are going to change, but that certain types of administrations are going to require much higher kind of standards, they're going to be having in their background, like, you know, in the back of their minds, like adoption of new technologies. And so there's a sort of underlying pressure that's still there, despite this fluctuation between administration to administration. You see that already in some fossil fuel plants where folks have already been phasing them out, not even though like the Trump administration adopted much more lenient rules for them, simply because they were concerned that a change in administration that they weren't sure about would happen and that they'd have to rapidly adopt, whereas it'd be more financially prudent to sort of plan things out beforehand.
How much do other markets around the world, I think especially the European Union, drive this? If I'm an automaker, I want to sell cars in France and Germany. Am I developing that technology anyway, regardless of what Americans are thinking about?
Yes, they absolutely do. And so sort of the global kind of regulatory system matters. Whatever the EU does matters. So they're responding to all of that. And so it's like a complicated calculus on their point in terms of what to anticipate and why.
Time for another caller. Steve is with us in New Glarus. Steve, hello.
Yeah, hi. Yes, I'm just reminded that back when this started before years ago, when they brought out electric cars because the gas prices were getting so high. And the problem with that was I made a mistake of buying one, but you couldn't go to a gas station. That's where they were supposed to charge them. They would charge the batteries on the electric cars, and they said they weren't allowed to because they all had contracts with the gas companies, the fuel companies, and they weren't allowed they were not allowed to charge any electric cars. So I'm just wondering if there's some way it wasn't a bad idea. Certainly, it was better than putting all the gas fumes in the air.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. And he brings up a really important point, Steph. And I know part of the latest infrastructure bill, one of the big goals is to boost charging. How much of that other stuff needs to happen to make these mileage standards meetable?
I absolutely agree. And I think that building charging stations that are strategically structured so that people can charge for long range kind of drives is extremely important. And I think that to the extent that the Biden administration can do anything to really boost the use of electric vehicles, it's doing very strategic plans to actually have those charging stations in place. One of the things that the Biden administration has said, and I don't know whether they're following up on this, but they've said that they're working with a number of various chains to sort of install charging stations. I anticipate this means convenience store chains, which are one of the more easily used for charging stations, because people can go in, shop around for their food, and then also get their cars charged. And so to the extent that they can really amplify that, I think that would be a really great way to address some of the charging issues.
Thanks a lot for that call, Steve. And just our last half a minute or so, Steph, what are you watching for next on fuel economy in America?
I think this is a really great change. I don't know whether it's going to get challenged by automobile manufacturers. There have been already things in the press with automobile manufacturers claiming that it's going to take way too much money to actually manufacture vehicles that actually meet up with these requirements, and that therefore the cost savings aren't so great on the part of consumers, because the cost savings will be exactly replaced by the cost of manufacturing those new vehicles. That said, traditionally, people have done meta studies on claims of costs of meeting regulatory requirements. And in general, it seems like those anticipated costs are way lower than the actual cost. So I anticipate that's going to be sort of in the background of all of this.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Steph Tai, professor at the UW-Madison School of Law, joining us for a look at fuel economy standards Monday on Central Time. We'll hear for a call for changes in dairy laws in the federal farm bill and how it affects Wisconsin, that and more. Coming up Monday here on Central Time.